Welcome to Trails Worth Hiking, the show that brings you some of the most interesting backpacking and trekking routes in the world. I'm your host, Jeremy Pendry. In the first part of the show, we bring you the story and history of a trail. Then we tell you what it's like to hike the trail and how you can do it. On this episode, we go back to Utah in the American West, but not to the deserts of southern Utah. Instead, we embark on a challenging, remote, high-altitude, up-and-down adventure through forests, subalpine meadows, crossing mountain passes above treeline, and filling up our water bottles in pristine alpine lakes, where we will be exposed not only to beauty, but also the weather, which can be an added challenge in a hike with so much open space and long views. On this episode of Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Uinta Highline Trail in the Uinta Mountains of northeastern Utah. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you for joining me. I'd like to start with an announcement from our sponsor, Outdoor Herbivore, about a new discount program for Trails Worth Hiking listeners. In the past, we gave you 10% off everything in Outdoor Herbivore's store. Now we're going to give you 15% off, but on Outdoor Herbivore's hot meals. So for Outdoor Herbivore's high-quality backpacking meals, vegetarian and vegan backpacking meals, which, as I always say, you don't need to be vegetarian or vegan to love. They have high quality ingredients and are delicious, regardless of whether you are vegetarian or not. Now you can get 15% off all the hot meals that Outdoor Herbivore sells with the discount code TWH15HOT, TWH15HOT. The 10% discount code we've used in the past is now retired and no longer valid, but you'll get this even better discount on hot meals. So now is the time to stock up on Outdoor Herbivore dinners for the summer hiking season. Get some of my favorites if you'd like the chickpea sesame zeti, the blackened quinoa, or the lemongrass Thai curry, among others. Don't forget that you can buy these from anywhere in the world. Outdoor Herbivore ships worldwide. This discount of 15% on hot meals is for a limited time only. We're putting out this episode in April 2024, and we'll likely run the special for the next couple of months throughout the spring. I apologize if you're listening in the future and the discount code is no longer available, but maybe there will be a different one available then. In any event, check out Outdoor Herbivore. Buy all the hot meals that you need to stock up for the summer with the discount code TWH15HOT. Thanks again to Outdoor Herbivore for supporting the show. And thanks to all of you who buy meals from Outdoor Herbivore for supporting the show by supporting them. So go to Outdoor Herbivore at OutdoorHerbivore.com right now to get your 15% off hot meals. All right, let's start with our Walking the Walk segment, where we highlight listeners who have hiked a trail after listening to an episode about it. On this episode, I want to highlight Jana and Grant Glaze, who reached out to me to let me know that they hiked two of the trails that we covered on the show after hearing about them on the show. They hiked the Alta Via 1 in Italy in the Dolomites, which we covered in episode 24, and they hiked the Pemmi Loop in New Hampshire, which we covered in episode 23. One really cool thing that Jana and Grant did is they made a video just for Trails Worth Hiking, where they thanked the show for having covered these trails that they went on to hike, and sent a video to me. And I have to say, that's the first time any listener has made a video just for Trails Worth Hiking, just for the show, just for me, I guess. And I really appreciate that. So thanks a bunch to Jana and Grant for doing that. They also made a YouTube video of the entire hike that they did in Italy on the Alta Via 1 to give back to the hiking community. And I will put a link to that YouTube video in the show notes. So thanks again to Jana and Grant Glaze. We're also going to do our Answering the Inbox segment, which we do sometimes when we get a good question from a listener. Bob Tressler reached out to ask about training for a hike when you plan to hike at altitude, but you don't live at altitude. So Bob's planning to hike the Tahoe Rim Trail, but he lives on the East Coast at a much lower elevation and wanted to get some tips for how to do that. And I thought it'd be worth sharing my response to him. And really, my main thought for this kind of situation is really to just overtrain and to be in the best possible aerobic shape you can be in. So there are two components to that. One is getting out and hiking a lot and really far distances as much as you possibly can and getting ready for the hike so that you're just in the best aerobic shape that you can be. The other is to hike uphill and downhill as much as you can. Even if you live in an area that's relatively flat, I'm sure you can find some staircases or you can find a park that maybe goes to a river where there's some downhill and you can do a lot of up and down in an area like that, even if you're not at elevation. So again, if you are looking to do a hike that's at elevation, but you don't live at elevation, I recommend overtraining for aerobic capacity, whether that's on treadmills or elliptical machines or outdoors or on stair climbers or whatever you can get your hands on. Really train aerobically as much as you can and also up and down hills as much as you can, even if they're not at elevation. The other thing that Bob asked about was what I do for electrolytes. And I can't remember if I've mentioned this before, but the two things that I swear by are Noon tablets and salt sticks. So Noon tablets are little round tablets that are essentially the equivalent of like a Gatorade mix, but have very little sugar. So just the electrolytes you need with only a little bit of added sweetness. And they add a little bit of carbonation, which I tend to like, to the water that you put them in. So you get a little bit of fizz, a little bit of flavor, and all the electrolytes you need. I tend to drink water flavored with Noon tablets pretty much all day when I'm hiking. I don't drink plain water that often when I'm hiking. I pretty much just drink it with added electrolytes. I used to get pretty severe cramps. And so for me, having electrolytes in my water throughout the day when I'm hiking was a game changer and has allowed me to do the hiking I want to do, where before it was really debilitating at times with the cramps I would get in my calf or in my thigh or other places that made it impossible to do the hiking I wanted to do. I also use salt sticks, which are essentially taken like a pill rather than flavoring water. They do the same thing. They add electrolytes. I will tend to take a salt stick at the beginning of the day before I start hiking and at the end of the day when I get into camp as a little insurance to make sure I've gotten enough electrolytes. For some of you listening, this may sound like overkill, but if you're someone like me who tends to sweat a lot when they're hiking, it really is important to make sure you have enough electrolytes, and I've found it makes an enormous difference for me. So thanks to Bob Tressler for writing in with those questions. All right, on this episode, our guest is Christian Paul. Christian Paul is from Utah, and he is a photographer and a YouTuber as well, and really has been a hiker of the Uinta Mountains for pretty much his entire life, as he talks about in our conversation. So no better person to talk about this incredible hike in the Uinta Mountains than Christian Paul, and I'm glad he came on the episode to tell us about it. This is a trail I really wanted to cover and was excited when Christian reached out to me about it because I had planned to hike this trail in 2021. I had done the research. I had planned how I was going to do it. But at the last minute, I ended up switching it up and doing the Ruby Crest Trail in Nevada, which we've covered in episodes 7 and 20. In episode 7, we covered the trail before I had hiked it. And in episode 20, I covered my hike of it with my son, Justin, and my friend, Tony. And the real reason that I ended up doing the Ruby Crest Trail instead of the Uinta Highline Trail was simply I didn't have enough time that particular summer. The Uinta Highline Trail was a more involved project that would have taken me probably a couple of weeks versus the several days it took to do the Ruby Crest Trail. The Uinta Highline Trail is one that's a pretty big lift with no resupply, really. and big sections exposed above treeline. It really does have epic adventure written all over it, and it's one I still really want to do. So nonetheless, I'm glad we're able to cover it on the show, and maybe someday I'll get a chance to do it. Let's talk about the Uinta Mountains. The Uinta Range is the highest mountain range in Utah. It ranges from 8,000 feet in elevation in lower canyons to 13,528 feet at the top of King's Peak, which is the highest point in Utah, and of course, the highest point in the range as well. One really interesting thing about the Uinta Range, it's the only major range in the contiguous United States with an east-west orientation. All the other major ranges in the U.S. run essentially north-south. The Uintas are mostly in Utah, but also extend a bit into Wyoming and Colorado. They are a sub-range of the Rocky Mountains. They lie about 100 miles east of Salt Lake City. The name Uinta comes from the Ute word meaning pine forest or pine tree. So it comes from a Native American word. The Uintas are made up of rock that is about 700 to 760 million years old, but the range itself didn't uplift until about 70 to 50 million years ago. In addition to uplifting during that time period, the range was also heavily shaped by glaciation during the last ice age. Though interestingly, there are no glaciers left today in the Uintas, which makes it the highest mountain range in the contiguous United States that doesn't have glaciers. That's in part because Utah is a very dry climate. The Uintas do get precipitation, but mostly through snow in the winter. Though, as we discussed, there are some summer thundershowers and other rains that Christian encountered during his hike. The range has about 500 different lakes, and maybe up to 1,000 to 2,000 if you count smaller ponds. So quite a bit of water throughout the range. The south and east parts of the range are part of the Colorado River watershed via the Green River, and the western runoff goes primarily into the Great Salt Lake in Utah. The range has quite a diverse fauna and flora. As far as trees go, there are lodgepole pine, subalpine fir, Engelmann spruce, Douglas fir, and quaking aspen. The mammals include elk, deer, moose, pronghorn antelope, mountain goats, bighorn sheep, bears, mountain lions, coyotes, red fox, badger, weasel, and maybe even some wolverines. There are a lot of birds. There are raptors, including golden and bald eagles. There are a number of different types of hawks. There are turkey vultures. There are several species of owls. And there's also sage grouse and ptarmigan. Native peoples have been in the area for thousands of years. Bighorn sheep bones have been found that are linked to early hunters. And by 400 AD, there was farming by native peoples in front of the range. But the climate had cooled by 1300 AD, and that made farming corn, which is what they were farming at the time, more difficult. These people are today called the Fremont people. By 1300 AD, there were a different group of people called the Numic people that hunted and gathered in the area. They appear to have come from west of the range. There were two primary groups, the Utes and the Gosuites. By 1400 AD, the Utes were in two different groups, the Timpanogos and the Uinta. Though today, the Timpanogos people themselves point out that they are actually Shoshone people and not directly part of the Utes. So there may be some lack of clarity there on the origins of the group. But in any event, in late summer, the Timpanogos collected nuts and berries in the Uinta Range and hunted game there. So essentially, you had native peoples for a really long time. And as is so often the story, eventually people of European descent arrived and things changed. But in the case of the Uintas in Utah, it's a slightly different story than the rest of the United States. In 1847, the Mormons arrived. At the time, Utah wasn't yet part of the United States. It was then Mexican territory. But the Mexican-American War was already ongoing, so that would change quickly, and it would soon become territory of the United States. The arrival of the Mormons in Utah led to conflict with the Utes and Gosuites. As always, I'm not here to pick sides or assign blame, but I do think it's important to point out that this region of the United States had limited resources to support populations, and Mormon settlements limited the land the Utes and the Gosuites could access for hunting and fishing, and this ultimately did lead to conflict. In 1853, there was the Walker War with Chief Wakara. That war lasted about a year. And by war, I mean a series of skirmishes that were ongoing between the Utes and the Mormons. In 1854, Brigham Young negotiated a peace with the Utes. And by that time, 27 Utes and 10 settlers had been killed in various raids over the year. In 1864, there was the Black Hawk War. This arose in part due to the ongoing civil war in the United States at the time. The United States had agreed to provide certain resources to the native peoples. Because of resources being diverted to help the civil war effort, the resources promised weren't being provided to the natives in Utah. This led to winter hunger and even starvation and more fighting over resources. With the fighting, there was also efforts by the Utes to drive cattle off the Mormon lands. And a Native American named Black Hawk led skirmishes until 1867, when he finally struck a peace deal. The Black Hawk War resulted in the loss of 5,000 cattle and 90 settlers and militiamen, and many, many more Utes. In 1867, the Transcontinental Railroad came through Utah and was being built there until 1869. This required a lot of lumber to be harvested from the Uintas to make railroad ties. Ties were milled and then floated down the Weber River to be used to build the railroad. So that's a bit of history of the area the Uintas are in. Today, the range is part of the Uinta-Wasatch-Cache National Forest, which is a combination of three national forests that are administered now as one. They were combined in 2007. Though within that national forest, much of the trail is in the High Uinta Wilderness, which was designated as a wilderness area in 1984. As you may recall from prior episodes where we've talked about wilderness designations in the United States, this keeps the areas free from any kind of structures being built there or roads being put through or use of machines. The High Uinta Wilderness is also partly in the Ashley National Forest, though most of it is in the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest. All right, with that background, let's jump to my conversation with Christian Paul about his hike on the Uinta Highline Trail. Christian Paul, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you have hiked quite a bit over the years in the Uinta Mountains. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I started hiking in the Uinta Mountains when I was about seven. I had a grandfather that was a World War II vet. That was his favorite thing to do, was to go in the Uintas and fish. So he would make me carry the peanuts and the worms. And he never used the worms. He was a fly fisherman. I'd catch maybe like a fish all weekend, and he'd be over there just slaying it, you know, getting like 40, 50 fish in a weekend. So I was kind of like that. You know, my dad traveled a lot for sales, so he was kind of like my babysitter when I was younger. And so he's the man that introduced me to the Uinta Mountains in the first place. And, you know, once you go out there, and, you know, hopefully we'll get you to come out and do that, you'll understand why it's a beautiful place, and it definitely gets into a part of you for sure, and you never forget it.
So you've basically been hiking in these mountains your whole life.
Well, yeah, partially. My 20s, I spent traveling as a professional DJ. So I had kind of moved away from like the outdoor activities post high school, and I kind of came back to it because of some health issues. Being a nightclub DJ, diet's not very good. You don't sleep very often. And I kind of wanted to get my health back in my early 30s. And so I started, you know, early, you know, right after the millennium, like 2001, 2002, I started hiking again. And then, you know, hiking wasn't enough, so I had to start backpacking again. And it just snowballs from there. It, you know, and anybody that's a backpacker knows once you start, you're just hooked. So it's, you know, that's kind of how everything began for me.
So you left DJing behind, but you're still in the arts somewhat. You have a business called Christian Paul Photography. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I've been shooting photography since I was in junior high. It's kind of an art that I moved away for because I was playing music for, you know, a couple of decades. And then I came back to it just because I was out in these beautiful places and I had my camera with me, and it was just a chance to like start that experiment all over again. Because shooting photography is definitely an experiment. You know, it's exposure and time and light. And it was definitely a really cool to kind of like take what I was doing. I was doing a lot of macro photography with film when I was in junior high and high school, you know, which is like up close, you know, depth of field photography, where, you know, that landscape photography is a much bigger animal because, you know, you don't have a controlled studio situation. It's whatever the sun's giving you at the moment. So it's all about finding that place to stand and then, you know, using some rules of thumb with light and, you know, trying to make your art out of it. And I just really found that I love doing that. I love shooting at landscape photography. And then I got kind of into the night photography and astrophotography end of it. And so then digital, you know, was a new animal when I got back into it. So I went to college and got a college degree here in Salt Lake Community College for photography to come up to speed with the digital animal and how the digital sensor works. And it's, you know, how you can reproduce photography with that. So.
And you've actually taken it now from entirely still photography to some video with your YouTube channel. So what could people find on your YouTube channel?
So that was part of the college experience, is that I had to take these electives in the art program. And I've always wanted to make, you know, videos. And I did do some work with Flash, which is, you know, nobody uses it now, but it was, you know, it's one of those like technologies for like, you know, web design and stuff. So I'd understood the timeline and taking, you know, segments of things and putting them in a timeline. And so I'd already sort of understood that. So when I took the class, it was just a lot of fun, but I really never did anything with it. It was just like I did these projects that were really fun, and then the pandemic broke out. And so like I couldn't see my family, and I couldn't see a lot of my friends, and they all wanted to know what I was doing. And, you know, it wasn't really a COVID problem to go backpacking, right? Like, and so it was just kind of a way to introduce them with what I had learned in school, how to produce video and edit, was to share where I was going. And all of a sudden I started getting subscribers. And people were liking it and starting to talk to me in the comments on my videos. And I was just kind of like a little blown away, actually, like, hey, I didn't expect this to go anywhere where it's gone. And now it's like video a week. And you know, I'm always hiking somewhere new. I've done backpacking in the UNS for the year that winter has come back to the range. But, you know, I'm still doing the hikes here in the Wasatch. We don't have any snow in the Wasatch right now. So, but that's kind of where the video end of things came from. It was just kind of an experiment on YouTube, and people have really liked it a lot, and I get a lot of like really good feedback and emails from people that they really love my stuff. One guy was, you know, suffering through a cancer treatment, and he said my videos really helped him, and that really meant something. So I've just kind of carried it on doing it for them, I guess. You know, it's more exposure for my photography, and it's just another skill set that I picked up along the way when I was trying to get the digital animal dialed in the still world. So. And the time-lapse role, too. That's been fun to do a time-lapse as well.
And so for folks that want to check that out, I'll put a link in the show notes. But you did several videos on this trip on the Uinta Highline that folks can check out as well.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's after we have this conversation, watching that four-part series, it'll probably really tie it all together for sure. So.
And so you go on the Uinta Highline, and my understanding is that you wanted to do this for a long time. So talk a little bit about that, about how it'd been something you'd been thinking about for many years and how you finally decided to jump in and do it.
I learned about this trail about 25 years ago. That there's an author named Jeffrey Prost, and he wrote the book that pretty much was the thing that led to my addictions to this mountain range in its current form. He had talked about this trail in there, and you know, it's kind of the pinnacle of any Uinta backpacker. You're always thinking, I want to do the Highline Trail. It's just that I'm sure people that are in the Sierra want to do like the John Muir or something like that. It's just something, you know, if you're a Uinta backpacker, you're always, you know, respect the guys that do the Highline, because it's like the pinnacle hike in the Uinta mountain range. And yeah, you know, I used to carry a 50-pound pack. Way too much gear, packed all my fears. Like, it was a horrible, like, can't even believe I used to carry that kind of weight. I've been able over the years to dial down to a UL setup. I'm a little more manageable for longer miles, take less breaks, can cover the distance you need to. And so that's where it kind of progressed to. And I started looking at it in 2020. I mean, started procuring gear for the trail that I thought would work best. I mean, I feel like I've spent so much time out there, understand the weather cycles and the temperature swings and stuff like that. So I was really able to kind of put together a kit that was going to keep me sub 30 pounds with all my food for 8 days out there. And that was really the goal that I was working towards. And it's a 20-year dream, 2 years to put it together. And we pulled it off. And as you'll see, it was a fantastic adventure. So
who did you hike with?
The three of us was myself and then Jim Remley and then his son, Michael Remley. And they're both engineers, by the way. I'm a photographer, so I'm the least experienced in problem solving on the trail with these two guys. And Jim is an amazing human being. He works for a custom prosthetic company out of Germany. And then his son is an engineer for a water plant design company here. So having these guys on trail, the conversations were always very intellectual. These guys are like real funny, but really smart. If you've seen Mark Rober, the big YouTuber guy, that's the engineer that does like the Porch Pirate glitter bombs. They're that kind of engineer. They're very, very cool guys, very smart. And you learn a lot from them. And Jim had reached out to me on Facebook. He had seen my posts from my son. He's like, hey, you ever want to go backpacking the U.S.? I'm like, yeah, sure. First time we ever went, we just hit it off. We talked about it over a couple of years. Hey, do you want to do the Highline? And the end of 2021, both of us just said, yeah, let's just start working on it. And so that was where we initially started like honing in this plan for this trip, was like end of 2021.
So what did you do to plan for the trip? What were the resources and what was the process like?
So, you know, you obviously got to figure out how many days you're going to be out there, how many nights you're going to be sleeping, how much food you need, how many calories per day you need. So it was just a process of like, you know, figuring out when we could travel, you know, and that what we needed, because the stretch that we did was carry all. There was no resupply option. So, you know, we're starting to finish. So I got to figure out how much food per day to meet my caloric intake, but, you know, also not burn myself out on sugars and stuff like that. So finding a balance in that nutrition as well. Jim's like has something I'm completely jealous of. He has a freeze dryer, one of those really nice, like Nature's Harvest freeze dryers. So they were able to freeze dry like 90% of their main meals. They even freeze dried hummus for the trail. Huh. And I was the lucky recipient of a few meals before we left town. So I got to eat some of that deliciousness on the trail. So a lot of, you know, like meal planning, a lot of like, you know, hey, we're going to be at this place and this night. I fly fish. I'm an avid fly fisher in the backcountry. I had gotten into a type of fishing right before this trip called Tenkara fishing. And I'll go into that a little bit later on it, but that was the fishing rig that I took with. So we had planned fish, so we did plan like little tinfoil and spices on the trail so we could have some fish dinners to supplement what we were bringing in the bags. And then it was just like planning mileage that, you know, this was our, you know, our point day one, our point day two. And as you well know, like that never always, you know, you sometimes, yeah, I want to go here, but then, oh, I'll just walk an extra 10 miles that, you know, like that, yeah. That kind of happened a couple of times on this. So where we had like gone a little farther or not gotten far enough, depending on weather and such like that. But, you know, that was pretty much it. Like, you know, we mapped our way out on the Garmin base camp for the map for us. And, you know, just like understanding like the terrain we were going to be in. I almost didn't bring rain pants with me. And we'll get into that because I don't know if you watched the videos or not, but I almost left my rain pants at home, and I am so glad that I did not do that.
I watched. Okay, I won't claim that I watched all of them yet, but I will.
That's okay.
I was trying to think of what I should say, but no, I did watch them. I started to watch them at least, and I watched the first one, and it rained on your first day, I think.
Oh yeah, like we got out of the car 20 minutes into our hike. It was drizzling on us, and by the time we got to the base of North Pole Pass, it was like full raging thunderstorm on us. We just found a big boulder to shelter under. It was like almost like a ledge overhang. And that's when I threw on the rain pants. You know, then it broke there, but it was the next day where we had to hike all day in the rain. And so like, you know, it was just logistics of like, at home, I've done a bunch of Alaska backpacking, and you just never leave house without rain gear in Alaska because you know, if you don't like hiking in rain, you're not going to like hiking in Alaska. And there's a lot of the terrain in the Uintas is very similar to the taiga and stuff you get in Alaska. And so, you know, it rains out there. And when it rains, it pours because you're just such high elevation and there's no cover. You know, just like understanding the weather report that we had that we were going into that week really defined like how we put our gear together for our trip. And I think we nailed it. I was happy with how everything turned out and, you know, the resources we brought. It just made the experience that much better. So we could just focus on, hey, we got to get from this point to this point today. Then we got to get to this point the next day, and having those resources in check helped us do that.
And so for doing such a long stretch in one haul without resupply, did you do some physical preparation, some training to get ready for this hike?
Yeah. So I don't know about you, what you did in the pandemic, but you know, I was doing my photography business. And then I was a part-time Lyft driver. Well, my kids got sent home from school. And so I can only work on my photography business. I had to be here because my wife has also worked from home for her business that she works for. And so it kind of changed the dynamic for me on what I was doing with myself that year. And I probably sat around and ate horribly, and you know, the microbrewery down the street was doing $4 growlers. And I had ballooned to like 230 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I was not healthy. I you know, probably was depressed and,
sure,
you know, the whole world's going mad. And, right, you know, I'm sure everybody has their own unique story from it. And that was, so I kind of just had this, you know, epiphany of like, okay, you know, this is a good chance to stay. I'm always like, I like a challenge. So I was just kind of, here's a challenge. This is like, I can change my health. I can change my outlook, my nutrition, what I'm doing with myself. So I started walking a mile a day, started eating healthier, sleeping better. I did 288 days before this trip with no alcohol.
Oh, wow.
At all. And I love beer. So that was like, a lot of people were tripped out that I like literally almost did an entire year without drinking. They thought that was insane. But I really did it for this trail because I wanted to do this trail. I wanted to do this trail so bad that I made a lot of life changes to step into this and do this. So yeah, and that was, so, and I'm still doing my walk a day. If I don't go hiking, my hiking counts for my mileage in the week. I haven't taken a day off from doing it. So I'm at least getting 7 to 10 miles of walking a week. And I haven't taken a day off in 3 years.
That's fantastic.
From that walking routine. So, and you know, just eating healthier, trying to stay away from the hydrogenated oils. I suffer from a little anxiety and PTSD. So I had added a new supplement called ashwagandha to my routine every day. And that really seemed to help my stamina and energy a lot. And I just noticed that when I did these like life changes, like all this other stuff changed and it just felt good. And so going into this, I really felt prepared. The day we were getting dropped off at the trail, I just felt so ready to go. Never felt so ready to go for anything in my life.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, this was just a chance to like, hey, you know, the world's going to hell. Let's make ourselves better. Let's be a shining light in all this darkness going on right now. And I have a lot of friends that like went and did the whole like, you know, year without alcohol, and we all do Sober October now. And you know, like my rule of thumb now with drinking is I can drink from Friday at 5 p.m. till Sunday at midnight. Then there's no more drinking till next Friday.
Well, that's great that those kinds of habits have carried through and that you've made them part of your life. And it's something that you started, like you said, because of a difficult situation we were all experiencing, and you turned it into something positive. And it sounds like you've done the same thing with your photography business and your YouTube channel and all of that. So that's great. So let's talk a little bit about the logistics for this hike.
Okay.
It sounds to me like it's really just a summer season hike. There's really no other time of year you can do this, but you tell me if I'm wrong about that, or maybe early fall.
I think this trail is usually like at late June until like October, first part of October trail. I think pushing that first part of October, you definitely got to go be prepared for snow. Got to have the traction in there, you know, be prepared for those winter temps. I did my first week in October, I was done out there. It snowed. I haven't heard of anybody doing an entire highline. I've heard of people doing section ski touring, but not backpacking or you know, like anything, no winter camping out there at all. So this is definitely more of a early summer to early fall time frame. So I would say like, if you don't want to have to deal with snow on the passes, you know, mid to late June till that October 1st timeframe is your window.
And so maybe I should have known this by the name, but I actually researched this trail a couple of years ago when I was actually thinking of doing it, but I didn't end up having the time. And one of the things I noticed is how much of it is above tree line and exposed. And that's something that, you know, you went to Highline should have given me a clue that's what it is. But I didn't realize that until I started seeing the pictures of it as I was looking into possibly doing this hike. And one of the things that occurred to me is when you're in that part of the country, I think of Colorado because that's where most of my experience is in that part of the country, is that you really have pretty frequent thunder showers in the summer. And so I'm thinking lots of thunder showers above tree line. How did you manage that as part of preparing? And then, you know, you mentioned already that happened during the hike. So how do you think about that? Do you try to like go over passes early in the day, you know, things like that to avoid big problems? Or do you have to stop early in the day before the thunder showers start? Or how do you think about that in planning?
So, you know, definitely early rise, get your breakfast, coffee, bag packed up, moving. You know, I've been in some doozies out there in the range over the last 20 years where, you know, I've almost been struck by lightning 3 times. You know, the weather gods to us till the very last day were pretty kind to us. The rain that we had was this record-breaking monsoon that was way later in the year that it was supposed to come through. This in 2022, you know, our monsoon usually ends that first week in August. We go into a dry section. So we had timed it that way. So we had the least amount of possibility of those raging thunderstorms, especially, you know, going over a couple of these passes in thunderstorms would be very treacherous, if not putting your life in danger, because they, you know, I've heard the people climbing King's Peak and they tell me that they felt their hair standing up when they were climbing it. And that's, you know, that's the electricity between the ground and the clouds looking for leaders. And we were lucky the first part. It wasn't so much thunderstorm when we got on North Pole Pass and over, but it was just heavy rain, just like, you know, filling the trail up where the trail becomes like a running river type of rain. And we don't, you know, the UNs will come in and it'll do this thunder shower where, like, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, you'll see those dark clouds building from the west. And then by 3 o'clock, it'll pound you with some, it'll sound like a bowling alley and you'll see a flash boom a couple of times and it'll just dump hail and rain on you for like 20, 30 minutes. And then boom, it goes clear. You can go out fishing. I mean, that's usually how it is. And this was different. This was like that monsoon type weather that you see in July in the range. We didn't really like, you know, we had calculated our timing moving on the trail each day and where we wanted to be, you know, what our destinations were for each day to try to avoid that thunderstorm window. Fortunately, of all the times I've been in the UN, is this trip didn't have the thunderstorm logistic like all the other ones have had, where like we did get pounded really hard by them. So it's just the rain, just constant rain. And I was telling Jim and Michael, hey, this is how it is in Oregon, you know, where I live. This is how it rains there. It doesn't rain like this in the UN, is where, you know, it starts raining and 18 hours later, it's still raining sideways. That's what it was doing on us those first 2 days.
Wow.
So yeah, but we, each day we, even though that possibility didn't seem like it was there after that, we were still timing those passes to get over before that. We call it the afternoon witching hour, because it that's when those storms come in and they get mean. So yeah, you definitely want to, you know, get that bag packed. I suggest trail 7, 8 latest. You starting after then, you're risking being up there if one does pop up. So.
And what about gear wise? Is this pretty much standard mountain backpacking gear, or any special considerations about food storage because of animals? I mean, in the Sierra, we deal with bear cans and all of that. I don't know if there's any need for that in the Uintas.
You know, the Uintas have black bears. There hasn't been a grizzly bear in Utah since 1912. That was the last grizzly bear that was alive that was shot and killed here. So black bears are very low elevation animals in the Uintas. They rarely come above 8,000 feet. I've been backpacking the Uintas for over 20 years, and I've seen one black bear in the entire time I've been. And that was like way on the east side by like Flaming Gorge. And I expect that over there because all the boaters and car campers and stuff. I mean, it's just a smorgasbord of smells for those bears over there. Where, like, you know, that they're not going to come up at a 10,000 foot basin unless they're just crossing over. So, you know, technically the food regulation is to hang and no food or scents in the tent. Is the rule. We did hang our food bags, but it wasn't for bears. It was for the squirrels and chipmunks. You know, they get quite used to, you know, humans at these different campsites along the trail. And so, you know, they've kind of made a living off of the thru hikers that go go through on this trail. So we were just hanging it at night just to, so they wouldn't, you know, dig a hole in our pack or, you know, chew a hole in the tent. And we were just that's really what it was for. It's more I call it, it's not a bear bag. It's a squirrel or chipmunk bag. Cause that's what it was on the trail is we're just hanging in those for those. And if you've been in a situation or an area that has a problem with the little critters, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I definitely do. What about navigation? Is this pretty easy to follow or do you need to have apps downloaded or did you work with maps or is the signage pretty good? How did you do that?
I used my Garmin InReach Mini and then the EarthMate app so I could, you know, compass on the go and then I could use the arrow to show on the route, you know, was I getting off the route? I would say 90% of the route is pretty straightforward trail in front of you. You can see the path. And if the path disappears into grassy meadows, there's very huge cairns out in these meadows, cairns of rock stack. I mean, these ones are like chest high to sometimes they're as tall as you. I mean, you can't miss them and they'll put them like 200 yards apart from each other on the trail. So, you know, you get to one, you can see where to go for the next 200 yards because you'll see some trammel down ground between these. But I never found really, there was one section between, Kidney Lakes and Painter Basin where we got into this tree section and the trail just vanished. And I had my GPS that was able to point us to, we got back on to where the actual footpath was, but it did turn us for a second in this tree section. So, and there is one right turn past Kidney Lakes where like there's a cairn. And if you go left, you'll go downhill like 50 yards and then realize, whoops, I've got to go back up that. And there's a website called unahighlinetrail.com that their page on that section of the trail, that information was priceless because we didn't miss it. We nailed that turn where everybody hits it. I've had like five friends do this trail and they all missed that turn.
That's funny because I've been on trails where something like that will happen where the actual wrong direction will have a pretty strong path because so many people have gone the wrong way. And so you think, well, this must be the right way because there's all this trail here. But then you realize pretty quickly that it peters out and everyone else is doing the same thing you've been doing and turn around and you have to go back and figure it out. So yeah, that's pretty common, I think.
That's exactly what this is, that turn. That turn to the left, it's a well-trammeled path. So it looks like the trail and no, if you turn right, you'll go like up this little incline and there's a cairn right there. And it shows you that's where you're supposed to go. So we actually luckily made that one. So we never really had any problems getting lost on the trail. It's pretty straightforward. I would just suggest like, you know, having a Garmin InReach or some sort of mapping device or app, you know, if you have like Gaia or some people use Onyx or whatever, you know, just make sure you upload the route prior to going and then just follow it. Let it walk you through it. And that's what our Garmin, the Basecamp map that we did, where we set up all of it. We knew exact mileage to camps because of it, because we put it in. And so when we would get to a certain area, we'd know, you know, okay, we've done 13 miles. We're here at camp. So, and that we could, you know, start peeking around and looking for a spot to set up and stuff. So
you mentioned, I think earlier that you got dropped off. How did you manage figuring out, did you have to get a shuttle or did you have a friend or family drop you off? Or how did you get to the start and get picked up at the end?
I'm guessing you're married because I've heard you talk on your podcast before and, yeah. And I'm married and both me and Jim have amazing wives that were willing to split the shuttle duty. Jim's wife took us to Chipeta Lake and then my wife picked us up and I'll tell you about that when we get towards that part of the end of the trail, because that was very cool.
Okay.
And I'm kind of a person that doesn't get emotional a lot. I'm pretty rock steady. And, that was an amazing day. And yeah, so we really had like, you know, wonderful wives that were really supportive of us wanting to do this trail. And they took the time out of their lives to drop us off and pick us up so we could do this. So most people usually like organize a shuttle where they'll either one way from like Camas and leave a car at Hayden Pass and then go out to either McKee Draw, Leedy Peak or Chipeta, depending on where they want to start. We were just lucky that with the time frame that we had, that the time lined up where the wives were able to help us out with that. So
are there any fees or permits required to do this or you just show up and do it?
No. So that you don't have to reserve like trail time like you do in some other spots to do like through hikes like this. If you were going to park, it's to say like you did the shuttle to the start and then you were just going to get in your car at Hayden. You need the Mirror Lake Pass, which is $6 for 3 days, $12 for 6 days. It's just a recreation pass you have to have for the Mirror Lake Highway. They won't ticket you. They'll just leave a warning with an envelope. There's a pay station right there on the road next to the Hayden Fork area where the Hayden Pass trailhead is. So, if you didn't pay it on the way in, you could just pay it on the way out. No one's going to boot your car or tow you or anything like that. But yeah, they do require that. I always just buy the America the Beautiful Pass, which is a national parks pass. That covers the Mirror Lake Highway 24/7.
Okay.
So if you have that, bring that with you and just put it in your window and you're good to go.
People pretty much hike this always east to west?
Not necessarily. On the trail, we had gotten, it was day three after the two horrible rainy days. We were on the trail from Kidney Lakes, head to Painter Basin and over Anderson Pass. And I ran into a gentleman that had done the whole McKee draw to Hayden Pass, then hitchhiked into Camas, went to the grocery store, resupplied, then hitchhiked back to Hayden Pass, and then walked from Hayden Pass to McKee draw. So he did over 200 miles round trip.
Wow.
Doing this to and fro. Yeah. I mean, that was pretty gnarly. And, obviously he had, an entire month of time to play with. And that really determines your time on this trail. It's like, how many days do you have? And how many miles per day do you want to do it? Yeah, this guy did 209 miles is what he was guessing he was going to do by the time he got back to McKee draw.
Cool.
The general rule of thumb is east to west, just because the Hayden Pass trailhead is so much more accessible to Salt Lake City and Camas and Park City and those major metropolitans. So if you flew into Salt Lake, rented a car, dropped it at Hayden Pass, took the shuttle out to your start point, most of the time you do see the east to west traffic. We did run into a couple of groups that were going west to east on our way east to west. So
this trail has something like 13,000 feet of, I think it's up and down or incline. Maybe that's just incline. I'm not sure. But, and several, I think seven mountain passes that you went over. And we've talked about it being pretty much, a high elevation. You mentioned that it has terrain that looks a lot like parts of Alaska, which is surprising to hear for something that's in Utah. And I guess it's because you're mostly above tree line. Can you talk a little bit about what this area looks like for someone who's never been to the Uintas and never been in this part of the Uintas? What does this trail look like? What is the terrain like? What do you see hiking on this trail?
So it's very glaciated peaks and valleys. It's not a lot like you see in Yosemite. This is a much more older, worn mountain range. So the glaciers that sat in these drainages, the Uinta Mountains are a very special and unique mountain range because they're one of the only east-west facing ranges in all of North America. So most ranges, their orientation is north-south, or they go on a diagonal. And the Uinta Mountain Range, is literally an east-to-west range. So it has these really long glaciated valleys. And then you get up into these, like, cirques and peaks, and they are a little craggy and jagged. But some of them are very, like, rolly and rounded. Like, North Pole Pass is not, like, some craggy thing. It's this big, rounded, flat thing you walk across, Anderson Pass and King's Peak are more glaciated and bouldery and stuff like that. And, going into like the Dead Horse and Red Knob area, you see the glaciation and jagged peaks in there. But most of them are these big, long, drawn glacial valleys that you're walking in. And so you'll be above tree line sometimes, and then you'll drop into a little bit of a forest when it drops elevation a little bit. And then you'll climb back up into these like big bouldery sections that are over the forest. And then sometimes you're on a shelf walking across the top of a valley. And then sometimes you're doing a big switchback up a big old, treeless pass. You might see some junipers here and there on the slope. That's about it. It's wide open and exposed.
So what makes this trail difficult? I mean, I know you were thinking about it as this is a long trail. You're going to go a long way without a resupply. I get that. But is this pretty much the way most of the Uintas are, or is this a particularly difficult trail because of the terrain?
I think this one's difficult is because when you get into a certain point of it, because of the logistics of it going east to west or west to east, across the top of the spines, you're literally walking across the top of the Uinta Mountains all the way across the range. I think once you get into a certain point, it's just as far to go back where you started as it is to just finish. So you really have to kind of commit, like, no matter what, once you're in so deep, you can't go back. And I think that's what made it so challenging to me is that there, if I do a weekender shot into like Red Castle or Amethyst Basin, well, I can just turn around and go out of there because it's, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 miles. I'm 33 miles into the trail and you're at North Star Lake and it's 50 miles in any direction to civilization, you're kind of just at that point, you like have realized, yeah, I've committed. I've really gone into. So I think that's the hardest part. I think the mountain pass situation, you've had a chance to do the Ruby Crest as well as I just did this past summer. And you know what that day three is like, where it's like 5,000 feet of vert and five summits to get over to North Furlong. And that's kind of what the UNAs are, but it's like this long glaciated slow climb that you'll do. And then right at the pass, you'll jump these massive elevations where it'll go from like 10.9 and all of a sudden you're standing at 12.8. And then you have to descend off the back of that in some crazy weird switchback that they've done on this slope that you're sitting there looking at it from the top going, how am I going to walk down that? And then the way they put these switchbacks in, they take horse packs down these and horse trains and stuff. And but you see these switchbacks and you're just like, how am I getting down that? Because it's so big. So I really think it's just kind of like you have this long gradual climb in all these basins. And then it's just all of a sudden, here, have a big mountain pass to go up and over. And then, you know, here, have a big, another long, like lose some elevation to gain it all back again up over another pass. And you do this seven times on the trail. And, you know, I think that the two hardest passes for me were Anderson and Red Knob. For sure, those really kicked my butt. The one that was the most psychologically scary was Dead Horse Pass. And that reason is you're literally switchbacking through a cliff band on a trail that's like no wider than two boots. Mm-hmm. And it's sloped on like a 30-degree slope towards the cliff end. Like all the, you know, you're on this angle and the rocks are loose and wet. And you have to do these switchbacks. And there's literally some spots where if you fell, you're going to go off a 50-foot cliff. So that one was psychological, but it actually was like one of the easiest passes to get up. It's just the psychological thing your brain's doing. Like, you can't fall here. No falling, no slipping, you know. So you're dialed. You're not, you know, I filmed some of this trail. That was one of the parts I did not film when I got on those switchbacks. It was all business to the top because I was not messing around with that.
I kind of like that feeling sometimes where you get that forced.
Oh, yes.
You get that like forced focus and you just like, there's an intensity about it that's sort of zen feeling of like, I have to pay attention to every step. And that can be a really kind of moment of clarity, you know, or a period of clarity when that happens.
I remember getting to the top and it was like jubilation and it's all that focus and that energy and that almost adrenaline that you put into that moment where you're just like, I'm going to get through this. And then you get to the top and it's just like, it's beautiful up there. The view is amazing. And we were just up there like, smile. We spent probably 45 minutes up on Dead Horse Pass, like photos and just like checking out the view because you're on this spine between two big drainages and it's just amazing the view up there because like Dead Horse Lake is this like, you know, turquoise blue lake that you're seeing with just these big glaciated valleys and peaks all around you. And it was just like pretty spiritual almost being up there. It was just like really, really cool. And that it drove that adrenaline so hard being in that focus mode that you're talking about. And when I got to the top, it was just like, woohoo, like, it's so cool to be here, you know, just didn't feel better, you know, it was awesome. So like, yeah, that was one of those amazing moments on the trail was finishing that. And it, you know, like I said, there were harder paths, like Red Knob kicked my butt. You go to this slog of these big, steep switchbacks. And then you get to the top. Then it does this huge descent, like 5-mile descent off the pass into the basin. By the time you get a Dead Horse Lake, your legs are just trashed because of all the downhill you did just to get there. And then it's like right when you get to the lake, it's uphill for a mile for like 600 feet. That one was really draining, but totally rewarding. The view from up on Red Knob Pass, if you get to do this, I'm telling you, you're gonna write me back, dude, that view on Red Knob Pass was amazing. It is. It's really amazing.
One of the things I liked about your answer on the last question also was that you talked about the remoteness adding to the difficulty. And what that says to me, that's like a psychological difficulty, right? Like that's not, there's nothing about that. It's necessarily physical, but it's also one of the things that's probably fantastic about this trail is that you're able to get that remote. And there's not a lot of places in the US where you can do that and really get that sense of being out there. So I think that's cool that you do have to have that psychological commitment to do the whole thing once you get to a certain point, because like you said, it's just as far to go back as to go forward. And so that's pretty cool. And it is definitely a challenge. That's a challenge to work through when you're hiking something like that. The idea that you don't have any support network right now, you've got to do this all on your own. And that's one of the cool things about being in that environment.
Yeah, that was something that we, all of us, we got to a point on the trail where we're just like, well, there's no turning back now.
Yep.
You know, that it was pushed through, and you know, we ran into people going into the trail. You know, you pass people on trail when you're doing the through hikes, and then we wouldn't see them again. And then I got home and had posted some stuff on social media, and hey, we saw in the trail, we had to bail out at this park, so we had this happen or whatever.
Right.
So they ended up having to go down to one of these remote trailheads and then beg for a hitchhike
right
out to like Vernal or Duchesne to get, you know, back into civilization. And that's going to be a logistical challenge for anybody. So you really, if I was going to go into the do this trail, you got to commit to finish is really the point of it.
Let's talk about the decision about where to start. You decided to do a section of trail that's a good chunk of the entire trail, but people do it in a little bit longer stretch, even potentially. Mm-hmm. How far did you do, and what are the options people have in thinking about where they want to start?
So the whole trail from McKee Draw to Hayden Pass is 104 miles. You can start at Leedy Peak, and that makes it 91 miles, or Chipeta Lake, which is 71 to 74 miles, depending on whether you do Kings, you know, you take some side trips to some lakes or whatever. That first 38 miles of the trail that leads to Chipeta is very dry in sections. There's one section that's 15 miles without water, and there's another section that's like 20 miles without water.
Oh, wow.
And the water you do get into, it's like cows. And so, you know, the year that we did it, I had 8 days. Jim had 8 days of PTO that he had, was able to take. And it was like all of us had that 8 days. So we had to kind of logistically figure out what do we want to do with those 8 days. And I actually had a buddy, George, he's an IT professional here in the Salt Lake School District, that was going to meet us at Chipeta and finish the other 71 with us. But by the time they got to Chipeta, they were so worked from having to carry so much water. Like they were literally carrying 5-6 liters across there, because they said that the sources that were supposed to have water were so dry in 2022 that there was no water on the trail at all. It was less water than normal in that dry section. And they were so beat by the time that he got to Chipeta. He messaged me when we were coming up the White Rocks Road. Hey, just go without me. I'm going home. I'm bailing out. So that's the logistical challenge, is that first 38 miles. You got to kind of think it's alpine desert, because you're not going to have, I think Hacking Lake's the first water source from the trailhead. And then from there, it's another 15 miles to like this meadow. I think it's below one of the Gabbro Pass that has water, but you got to start with 3 or 4 liters. Where if you start from Chipeta, I had a liter, and I was able to carry like a liter or a half liter with electrolytes with it the whole trail, because the water's plentiful from there. So I think also another reason why is the water situation, that 71 miles had so much available water that wasn't going to be a logistical challenge for us. We could filter anywhere along the trail. And you know, that's, I think that a big deal with us that year, just hearing from the Rangers, hey, be careful if you're going to do that section because it's really dry. And we were just like, you know what, 8 days is enough. We'll do this. And I would like to go back and do that first section, like maybe just walk that first 38 on a really good water year and check it out. But the one thing about this section we did is that it is boundary to boundary in the wilderness. That first 38 miles you're in, it's just forest land. It does cross a lot of ATV trails. Mm-hmm. You are going to have some of that traffic to deal with on that side of the range. So, because that side of the range is kind of more ATV, OTV access and such like that. A lot of hunters, a lot of horse packers, where like you're in the wilderness boundary, it's pretty much backpackers. You're not going to see, you know, stock animal very much. Really, from Chipeta to 150 was very few people we saw at all. So I think that's the quietest part of the trail from my experience. So,
okay. So how did you think about creating an itinerary knowing that you wanted to go from Chipeta to the end and do that 71 mile section?
So we actually didn't keep to our itinerary day one. We were only supposed to go up to Reeder Lake, which is like right below North Pole Pass. We were just going to go there and fish and just acclimate for the first day and then get up the next day and then go over to Fox Lake. But, you know, as it always happens, if you have a backpacker and a backpacker friend that's really gung-ho about wanting to move, we pushed into Fox Lake on our first day, which was way more mileage the first day than we were even planning on doing, which we were all, like, so proud of ourselves. We got to Fox Lake right before the big rainstorm came in and we had to jump in the tents. That, oh, we're so ahead of the game and blah, 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 blah. And we quickly got our rear ends handed to us the next day with the rainstorm on, like, only being able to punch out like 6 miles because it rained so hard on us. and we were crossing rivers and flooded streams and stuff like that. We were just so soggy and wet by the time we got to Kidney Lakes. It was definitely a humbling experience, is what I'll put it to you. That okay, yeah, we're not as far ahead as we thought we were. So yeah, so that's what changed on day one, was that we just pushed it a little farther than we should have, and it probably ended up benefiting us in the tail end of things. But I'll get to it in a minute when we talk about, we get into like Painter Basin and Anderson Pass. It did take something off the itinerary we did have planned. So
why don't you take me through that? So you started the first day, you went over, what was the pass the first day?
So you start from Chipeta Lake, yeah, and the trail kind of winds its way sort of northwest, mm-hmm, out of Chipeta Lake, and you kind of climb this gigantic glaciated basin. It's really pretty, and the views just keep getting better as you get to the top, but the trees keep getting thinner as you're going too.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had started on, if you saw that video, how it started, there was some pretty nasty looking clouds hanging over the top of North Pole Pass there. And as we were going up, it kind of started busting blue a little bit on us. And we're like, oh, well, you know, hey, here we go. We'll just be able to mosey wherever we want to go. And right when we got to the pass, it came in on us. And so we went up over North Pole Pass, which is like a 12,100 foot pass. You're way up there. And they call it North Pole Pass for a reason. It's cold on this pass, and it's long. And I can only imagine in winter, this probably dumps some of the coldest temperatures in Utah, because it is literally just this big, flat ledge that you walk across. And there is not a tree to be found up there. Just cairns, and then a well-worn track that the horse packers have done through here. So, and you see the first wilderness sign. And you also see the reconstruction sign for the High Line on this pass as well. And that's your first of the seven you climb, is North Pole. And it's one of the biggest. And that descent off the backside down to Fox Lake is just, it's like you're on these switchbacks forever. And they just, it's just like, never seems like you stop descending until you get to Fox Lake.
And then, so that's where you stayed the first night. And then the next day you went?
Camp one was Fox Lake. And then camp two, we had planned to push to Painter Basin, because we wanted to be at the base of Anderson Pass on day three so we could go climb King's Peak. Well, of course, you know, we had to have 4.5 inches of record-breaking rain, you know, first day into day two. So we made it from Fox Lake to Kidney Lakes. And by the time we got into Kidney Lakes, it was like 3 p.m. Everything we had was wet. Our rain jackets were sweated out. What happened is right when we got to Kidney Lakes, the clouds just broke and really warm sunshine came in. So me and Jim just looked at each other and said, yeah, we're going to park it here for the night, dry out. We'll start fresh, dry tomorrow. Looks like the forecast is looking a little bit better. You know, on Garmin, you can pull your weather report. We had looked at the weather report there, and it had shown us that, yeah, it looked like it was like 10% chance of showers the next day. So we knew, you know, 10% of the rains would get rain that day. That's not going to be us. It looked pretty clear on our end of things. And so we dried out at Kidney Lakes and actually had this beautiful night at Kidney Lakes. I really... If you have to stay somewhere on the thing, I almost would have left Fox had I known and just pushed to Kidney, because Kidney was so beautiful. I would have loved to have spent two nights there. That has just been awesome. It's such a beautiful lake in there. And there's two lakes. There's a East and West Kidney.
Okay.
It's just gorgeous. The cirque in there is beautiful. The trees are beautiful. And so we stayed there for night two and then got up the next day, and we pushed 13 miles through Painter Basin over Anderson Pass. But because of our mileage in the day and how late we got on Anderson Pass, we weren't able to do King's Peak. My partner, Jim, that was with me on there, he's done King's Peak 9 times.
Oh, wow.
And we got to that saddle, and I asked him, I said, hey, do we have time to do this? Because I wanted, if we had the time, he's like, if we go up it, we're going to be coming down it in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have to put the packs back on to descend Anderson Pass into Yellowstone Creek and try to find camp in the dark. And all of us just kind of thought that was a bad idea. And then we had been up there. Jim's always with his tech. This is the engineering thing. I think he's always tinkering with things. Of course, he has to find out he has cell reception on Anderson Pass. He gets a cell signal. And so he gets his wife,
uh-huh,
on the phone, and she proceeds to tell me, oh, remember those pictures I took of you at the trailhead? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, I texted those to your wife. And her mentioning my wife, and I don't know what it was, just literally like did that choke up, was going to cry for a minute thing with me. And I don't know if it was just maybe the elevation was getting to me. You know, we had done like 8 miles to the base of the pass, and we'd done two to the pass. We're at 10 at this point in the day. It's 6 p.m. It's freezing up there. And I don't know. I just kind of like almost kind of lost it. Like just thinking about my wife, it made me cry. And I love my wife a ton. So maybe that was it. And so of course I tried my phone and I was able to get her on FaceTime. So the kids and the wife were FaceTiming me on Anderson Pass. I mean, that's the only time we talked to them on the trip till we got to Rocky Sea Pass. But we had no idea we were going to have reception. We actually were able to talk to our families and check in without having to just send the Garmin message. We actually were able to check in and say, oh, I'm okay, honey. And I'm like, I miss you. And she's like, are you okay? And like, she's never seen me cry. Cause I just don't get upset. Like I'm very pretty grounded individual. And it was just like, you're in such a spiritual place. We've been through so much in the last, 24, 36 hours. I just think like the enormity of it had settled in. And I think it breaks down all your emotions when you're in the wild. It really does wear down that wall you put up that, oh, no one's going to see how tender I am, I think it got to me a little bit. I was like, wow. And I talk about it in my video going off the pass that, I was a little choking up on the pass talking to my wife and I don't know why. And
that's really well put, man, because I've been in that spot before. I know exactly what you're talking about. And it is something about being in a beautiful place like that. And especially when it took so much to get there, like you said, all this planning, all this hiking, going through all this adversity with weather. I've been in that kind of position before. My son and I were hiking Mount Whitney in September. Wow. And I had a moment like that when we reached the summit as well, where I was just like kind of emotional. And it's funny because you'll talk to somebody back home because we had reception up there as well. And they don't really like, they're not in the same headspace you're in.
Yeah.
And it can be a very awkward conversation.
I think my wife was going to be like, I'm quitting, honey. I'm coming home or something, And like, that wasn't it at all. I was just like so happy to see her, And she's just not used to seeing me get upset like that. So like, yeah, the headspace is totally different because, I'm up there like, this is so beautiful, honey. And, she's like, what is wrong with you? Because she's a hump, with the kids and luckily let me go and have my adventure. And so, I completely agree. It's a totally different headspace. And I think she got it in the tail end. Like when he's crying because he's happy. There was a lot of stuff that, from my childhood and trauma and things like that throughout my life that this whole process of not drinking and the exercising and the life changes and stuff like that. A lot of this was being shed while I was on the trail, because this was like the kind of culmination of like, nobody can ever tell me I couldn't do this. I got a lot of people tell me, you're nuts. So I can't believe you're going to go do this. And I'm just like, you should know me by now. This is where I'm at home. And, it's the right fit. And it was something I needed to do just to kind of like, I'm 49 when I did this, I'm 50 now. It was just kind of like, can I still do these things?
Right.
And I had to find out. It was just like one of those internal things that like, I wouldn't go to my grave happy if I didn't explore this and find out, can I do this? So yeah, that I kind of like wish Jim would have filmed like the whole thing on the past, because it would have been so funny to look back at, like, like how choked up I was about it and stuff like that. But it still kind of chokes me up just thinking about it. Even when I'm like home now, a couple years later, I'm still like thinking about that moment, because that was a pretty profound one for me. Because I like realized the depth of what I was in. It was like that. I think I was kind of in denial. We were almost in like survival mode because of the rain we'd had for 2 days. I like literally got to sink in at that moment, like where I was at, what I was doing, and like how profound that was. So
take us through the next few days and any of the highlights or things that people should be aware of as far as like good campsites or what to expect.
If you don't want to camp, so, we had done, Chipeta to Fox and then Fox to Kidney Lakes. And then we were supposed to do Fox to Painter that second day, but we did Kidney over to Yellowstone Creek. And Yellowstone Creek is, once you go over Anderson Pass to head to the next drainage, that's the next drainage you're in, is in Yellowstone Creek. And about 3 miles from the pass, there's some really great camping in there. There's water available right by camp. And, if they had a thunderstorm come in, you got a little bit of tree shelter you're down in. Once you leave the Yellowstone drainage to go over Porcupine Pass and Tungsten Pass, you're treeless. So if you're going to pitch camp in any of those drainages, whether you're in Garfield Basin or you're in the Yellowstone drainage above like where Tungsten is, or you're going to go into Porcupine, all of that is treeless. You're above tree line in there. So making a logistical plan to accompany those, that's the risk you're taking, is you're the highest point. So if it does come in and starts throwing lightning bolts at you, you're, you know, risk mitigation, you've definitely upped your risk factor. For us, we had planned to go to Lambert from Anderson, but, you know, obviously the rain delay kind of shifted things up. So when we got up in Yellowstone the next day, we went past Tungsten Lake and over Tungsten Pass, and that's beautiful. That shot into Garfield Basin is unbelievable. Like, one of the most beautiful views I've ever seen. And then we passed North Star Lake, which is the most remote lake in the Uinta Mountains. If you were to go from any point on that lake, it's 50 miles. So you stand on anywhere around that lake, and it's a 50-mile line to civilization. And so then from North Star, we climbed Porcupine Pass. And up, this is where you really start getting into more like the craggy, jagged, sort of a classic Western United States mountain range look to the range, because you're now on the side where it has glaciated and you're about to head to the only part of the north slope you see on the trail. So from Yellowstone Creek, we went over Tungsten Pass, over Porcupine Pass, and then we traversed all of Lambert Meadows to Lake Lambert, which was like 13 miles. So in 2 days, we did 26 miles and over 3,100 feet of elevation gain on this trail. And I think we were just so amped from the energy we had gotten from like where we were at. And, you know, this kind of, it's almost something spiritual that wells in you. And then we just felt good. I think we all had our trail legs at that point. We were all acclimated and we'd been doing electrolytes on the trail all the way across. So I think we were well hydrated. So I think our hiker legs were just moving at that point. And we punched into Lambert Lake for that next night after Yellowstone. And man, what a beautiful lake. And most people don't camp at Lambert. When they're in that section of the trail, there's like some ponds that sit up on the ledge above Lambert. But we wanted to fish. And so we went down to Lambert because we knew it had really big brook trout in it. And so we're like, yeah, we're going to go catch some brookies. And so we got in pretty late, got camp set up, you know, had a little fire, dinner, sat around and chit-chatted for a minute. And then all of us went to bed. I got up like the crack of dawn, like the sun hadn't even gotten above the ridge yet, and took the Tenkara rod out for my very first time. And went out lakeside and caught a brook trout off my second cast.
Wow.
And then subsequently, right after that, I caught like a 16-inch one that was big. And I have a 9-foot, 6-weight regular fly rod that I fish with. And the Sierra from Tenkara Rod Company is the rod I took on this trail. And it feels very much like my 9-foot, 6-weight. But Tenkara is different because it doesn't have line that feeds out of a reel. It's a fixed line rod. So like there's a line fixed to the end of the rod, and then you use your finger to point where you want that fly to go, or you use a boomerang cast. It's more primitive type of fly fishing. It originates from Japan. It's, you know, about 400 years of history of Japanese fishermen using the Tenkara rod over there. They used to take a bamboo sprout and then put a line at the end of it, and that's where Tenkara got its origins, and then it's just evolved into what it is now. There's 6 gazillion rods on the market, and every size and handle and whatever you want to do. But I've really found that for the alpine fishing I do, this rod from Tenkara Rod Company has been the one that I've really enjoyed the most. And Jim also carried Tenkara. So we were, this, our entire crew was Tenkara fishing on the trip. He caught at Lambert as well. So after we fished, we had breakfast, broke camp, and then headed for Red Knot Pass. And that does a pretty interesting thing, because you come off the top of the ledge there, and then you drop down into Lake Fork. And that's quite the drop. You drop like 1,800 feet down to the river in Lake Fork, and then you have to climb all of that back up and then do Red Knot Pass to the top. And being on top of Red Knot Pass is pretty amazing, because you're looking in like all of Lake Fork, but then you're looking all in the West Fork's Black Fork drainage, where like Dead Horse Lake is, Dead Horse Pass is. So you're kind of on the dividing line between all these big, huge bases. Mount Lavinia, one of the biggest peaks in the Uinta Mountain Range, is like right there in your face. I mean, it's just like you're staring right at it. It's on the left side when you're up on that pass. And we dropped the packs when we were on that and spent quite a bit of time up there just watching the cotton balls float over the top of us and just really enjoying the view. And then we did the big descent and then headed to Dead Horse for the night. And that was probably the busiest camp on the trail that we had, because there was a lot of through hikers that were on the trail that had stopped there to camp. It is pretty picturesque. I did not catch a fish at this lake on my Tenkara rod, but Jim got quite the large size tiger trout, probably a 16-inch tiger trout, and we ate that sucker for dinner. We totally, like, I'm nice. not gonna. I put the ones back at Lambert, but this one we totally kept, because all of us were like, yeah, I want some trout tonight with my freeze-dried food. So So yeah, so we cooked that up and then had a really nice night by the fire up there. And you know, on the Uinta Highlands Trail, as long as there's not a fire restriction, you know, because we've had drought or whatever, you can have a fire as long as it's you're not one of the high use areas. Mm-hmm. Because there's permanent fire closures within 150 feet of most of the popular lakes out there. But if you're 150 feet beyond that, you can have a fire on the trail, which is not normal for most trails. But the UN as it is, we always put them out, dead out, very responsible about fire when I use it out there. I think it was just kind of a comfort thing for us. We're in this beautiful place having a campfire. Mm-hmm. You know, there's other trails that I have not had a fire on. It's the area rules, or, you know, they don't want fires to go on. This one, you can do that, but be very responsible with it because there's a lot of beetle kill. You'll see a lot of, we call them gray pines because they're the ones that have died because the beetles have killed them. And it's like one spark away from being like a raging forest fire.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of that in the Sierra. The bark beetles kill a lot of the trees.
Yeah. And it's terrifying. It's probably my worst nightmare as a backpacker is to have to run from a forest fire.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah. So from Dead Horse, how many more days did you have from there?
So we woke up the next morning at Dead Horse, and, you know, all of us were kind of like have a little bit of anxiety going on because we're like, oh, so you're like, you're sitting there. So you get to Dead Horse. It's the day before, right? So you've got all this time you're fishing and you're watching people go up this. You're just looking at them going, how are they even walking up this damn thing? Because it's just like literally a cliff band of like boulders. You can't see the trail till you're actually like on it because it's not like visible. You just see these bodies zigzagging up this thing that you're like, how the hell are they climbing this thing? And so when you finally get to go do it yourself, your anxiety is pretty ramped because you're just like, crap, like most places you can see a trail, right? You can't see this trail till you're on it. You know, we all accomplished it, got up there quick. Michael, you know, he was the 20 something in the group before. Me and Jim are like the old guys, you know? So like, he's like on top of the pass, like sitting in his camp chair when I come rolling up the pass and the Jim comes up right behind me. You know, we just got to the top and it was amazing. And so we spent some time up there, did some pictures, and then the drop off the other side into Ledge Lake it's a little more gradual. It's not as crazy as the actual pass you come up. And then we just kind of, we have a decision to make. Generally, there's two routes that go through the Rock Creek drainage. There's the Jack and Jill route that goes through, and then you have the Uinta route, which the Uinta route, it's a straight line across the basin, but it drops a bunch of elevation down to the river, then comes back up on the other side by Brinkley Lake. Well, about 5 years previous to this hike, there was a lightning storm that came through Rock Creek, and it lit all those beetle kills we were talking about on fire. So they had a raging forest fire in this, and that Uinta Trail, I'm just lucky because I know a bunch of people that are in the community, the backpacking and trail running community, that a friend of mine named Scott had advised me that he had gone through there. And he was trail running the High Line. So he like did it in like 3 days trail running it. And that when he got to the Uinta River, when there was 5 miles of deadfalls.
Oh, wow.
That were laying across the trail. So when he got home, I was like a week before my trip. He got home and he like messaged me immediately. He's like, take the Jack and Jill route. Do not go through the Uinta route. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm actually glad that I had to go that way because we got to stop and fish Jack and Jill lakes. And that has amazing brook trout. I had another fish dinner. We kept those fish at Jack and Jill and then hiked down to Ouray Lake. And Ouray Lake's where we stopped for night six. So we stopped. And this has this lake is amazing. It's like this kind of teal gray color to the water. Mm-hmm. But it's this like beautiful alpine cirque. And what you don't realize when you're standing on the other side on that is the other side of that cirque is Amethyst Basin, which I've been to like millions of times. But you're just not thinking about it until I got home and got to look at the map. And I was like, oh, yeah, the other side of that's just Amethyst. And you're getting towards the tail end of the trail now. You know, if you're in Rock Creek, you only have to go over one more basin to get into the finality of the trail. So we had stopped at Ouray and we just had these like, you know, monster 9 miles day, 10 mile day, 13 mile day, 13 mile day. And so this day was only like 6.5. And so we got camp built by like 12:30.
Oh, wow.
And so it was like Jim disappeared like a mile down the river. I think he went to take a bath. Michael was just beat. So he took a nap and I just got the 10 car rod out and just started walking around the lake and found all these ponds above the lake. And I spent probably 3 or 4 hours just like in the zone, just 10 carring out these like 8, 10, 12 inch beautiful brook trout. Like the markings on them were so gorgeous. And that was like the closest thing to a down day we had on the trail the whole time. Was just like, we got in set up by 12:30. So we just spent the whole time till dark, just like doing our own thing and kind of like, you know, relaxing and maxing and refreshing. And boy, I'll tell you, when I went to bed that night, I was like really, really happy. It was just like, I was calm. I had a chance to freshen up and clean up my clothes. And it was just like, you know, you're day six, night six, you've been on the trail for 6 days, no shower. You're not probably smelling so great at that point. And, you know, it was just nice to refresh and kind of be ready to go for that last pass on the trail.
And then what is the last pass?
So the next morning we woke up and Rocky Sea Pass. So we finished the Jack and Jill route around, and then it kind of circumvents kind of like north to south as you're rounding the basin. And then you make this right fork that takes you up to this pass that you're looking at, and it just looks like chunky boulders. Like, how am I going to go over this? But they have pulled the boulders to the side part of where you can get through with a person walking or a horse. So it's some switchbacks. It's not really technically hard. It was probably one of the easier passes we did on the trail. I think the only pass was easier than this was with Tungsten. Tungsten is not really a pass. It's more of just like a hill you go over. Mm-hmm. But we got to the top of this, and I think all of us just looked at each other and realized, wow, we have done every pass on the Uinta Highline Trail from Chipeta to here. And so I think all of us were pretty ecstatic. And Jim, of course, pops out the phone. Got to see if I've gotten cell reception. He gets his wife on the phone. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'll call my wife just to check in with her, make sure she's getting us the next day. And she was ecstatic we had made it. And you know, big congratulations for everybody. And then we could see some dark clouds building into Rock Creek, and kind of heard some distant thunder. So we're like, hey, we better get off this. And our last night was going to be at Carolyn Lake, which is on the Highline section from Hayden Pass. And so we dropped down to Carolyn Lake, got our camp set. I mean, I literally put the last stake in my tent and hopped inside to blow up my air pad. And it just came in thunderstorm, raining on us, dumping buckets. And so I had not had a nap on the trail the whole time we'd been out there. We'd just been either working on resources when we were at camp or hiking. So I crawled in the sleeping bag and took like a 2.5 hour nap while it thunderstormed on us.
That's awesome.
It was like the most so relaxing, just so relaxing. And then we got up and everything was pretty soggy. But there's really fast action graylings. I don't know if you know what an Arctic grayling is. That's what Carolyn Lake has in it. So we went out with the 10 car rods. We're fishing graylings, and these guys are like every cast you have a fish. So you like 20 minutes, you've got 50 fish on.
Wow.
So we fished for probably like 2.5-3 hours, got a fire going, had dinner, had a chance to kind of sit around and be like, hey, what was your favorite part of the trip? You know, Michael loved the passes. Jim thought the passes were great, and the fresh fish was really good. And I was in agreement with all that. Plus, I added in, you know, the dead horse pass experience was definitely like a psychological. Like, I had really jumped some psychological hurdles at that point from high points and being on high points with a top heavy pack and stuff. That really broke that wall down. I'm not so scared of that anymore as I was on that trip. And then we all went to bed. It came in again on us, like right as we had all crawled into our tents. Boom, flash, you know, lightning, thunder, rained on us all night long. And then woke up in the morning to the elk on day eight was calling from the meadows. I mean, you know what an elk sounds like when they call out.
Yeah.
That was the alarm clock at like 7 o'clock was the elk in the meadow. And we got up and made coffee, and Jim needed to charge some stuff. So I had some extra battery power left to charged some of his stuff on. Then we threw the packs on and we just made a beeline to the trail because we knew my wife was going to be on her way between like 12 and 12:30. And I was communicating with her with the Garmin saying, hey, we're on trail. She's like, yeah, I'm going to leave at this time. I'll see you here. And we pushed through. And this is a trail section we use quite frequently. There's a couple of other lakes. So there's Naturalist Basin you pass on this trail. The Packard Lake Trail is off of this trail, which is a regular Uinta haunt that I go fish and camp at and stuff. And we got to about Scudder Lake. It's where the burn scar stops from that forest fire I had talked to you about. And it just opened up and started raining on us again. Wow. And it was just like the trail was going to be like, yeah, one last soaker for you, buddy, you know? And so we threw on the rain gear and literally, I think all of us just like made this beeline to the trail. Jim, where he was putting on his rain part, he had a poncho that he was wearing, where he set his sunglasses down, and we had gotten past Scudder. And he all of a sudden stops and realizes, oh crap, I left my sunglasses. So he went all the way back to where we were putting on our rain gear to get his glasses. And then, of course, because he's a way faster hiker than I am, he passes me at the wilderness sign to head up to the trailhead because he's just hauling out of there at that point. I think all of us were just like, we've been out here for 8 days. We want to see our families. You know, it's time to go home. Adventure's over. And so we get to the trailhead. It breaks crystal clear skies. We're able to kind of dry out. And my wife shows up with cold beers and hot pizza.
Oh, my God.
To finish the trail out. Oh, my God. It was like, after being on the trail for 8 days, that was my first beer in 288 days.
It probably felt like even longer than that.
It was tasty. It was a Utah beer, which Utah's notorious for 5%. That's what you get in the grocery store. So it wasn't a spiritual experience by any means or anything like that. It was just nice to have a beer and warm pizza and you know, see my wife. I give her a huge hug and it was just like so happy to see her. And I think all of us just at that point had realized that we'd all accomplished like something really big that none of us were going to forget for the rest of our lives. This was an experience that we were going to definitely cherish. And it honestly, to this day, I still think, and I've done a bunch of loop hikes. I've been in a bunch of different wilderness areas all over the place. This is the greatest trail I've ever walked in my life. It's just an amazing place. The experience is just awesome. And it really challenges every piece of you to the bitter end. And when you get out, it's just so sweet, that feeling that you just overcome all of those challenges that trail threw at you.
You know, I usually ask why it's a trail that people should think about hiking, but I think you've just answered that. And and I also usually ask about a particular moment that was important to people, but I think you talked a lot about that moment where you called your wife the first time. That seems like that was a pretty pivotal moment for you on the trail. So I don't think we need to say more about that unless you want to.
No, that's fine.
One other thing that I sometimes ask that you can tell me if there's anything here is whether you would do something differently if you advise somebody else to do it. Is there something you did that, like gear wise or itinerary wise, that if you were to do it again, you would do it differently?
I definitely probably would have pushed the painter to climb Kings. Just that if you're looking to get that experience out of it. I wasn't hell-bent on climbing Kings. We had all kind of come into this trail that finishing the trail was the most important part. Climbing Kings Peak was not the most important part. I've done the hike in Henry's Fork where you can go over Gunsight Pass and get Kings. It's not hard. And I can go back and do that. Or if I do the trail again, you know, I can go and hit it again. So, but if Kings is on your itinerary to do this trail, make that push to Painter Base into camp because it'll give you that chance to summit even if there is thunderstorms because you can go early. Get that summit out of the way, get off that pass, get into Yellowstone, get camp set up, then you're good for the afternoon from the storm. So I probably would have pushed that. We wouldn't have stopped at Kidney. I would have pushed on.
Well, Christian Paul, thank you for telling us about your hike on the Uinta Highline Trail. But while I've got you, I've got a few more questions, if that's okay.
Yeah, no problem.
So what's the best backpacking or hiking advice you've ever gotten?
Don't pack your fears. And that really helped me get ultralight on the trail. It helped me move from a 50-pound situation to, you know, a 20-something pound situation because you're not bringing the kitchen sink. And so that was probably one of the smartest pieces of backpacking advice I've ever been given is don't pack your fears.
How do you decide which thing is a fear that you're packing versus something that you really need to take? And I ask that question because I think what you said is absolutely right. And I do that all the time. And sometimes I will pack and then I'll go back and look at everything and I'll think, no, I don't need that. No, I don't need that. How do you decide what is too much?
I'm a habitual overpacker in the food department.
Okay.
Like habitual. And this is something I've been trying to work on because, you know, I haul all this food way out there and I come home with half of it. And I'm like, why did I pack so much food? So this is that. And that's where that advice has really come into handy is like, it helps me like dial down, like, okay, this is what you get to eat for breakfast. Here's your snacks. This is your dinner. You don't need two extra Snicker bars in there. You know, like it's the discipline thing that like I needed help with. Like the other gear, like I can go with like such minimal gear, but if for some reason I have to put extra food in that bag and I don't know why. And so it's been something I've been working on very hard because I feel like it's a fear. I'm like packing, oh, I'm going to starve out there. And it's like, it's an overnighter. What's wrong with you? You don't need 3 days of food for an overnighter. You know, it's like, so that's where that comes in is that I've got it. And I've been so good about it that through hikes have really helped diet with the system I have with those, that really dials it down where like I only take what I need. I might come out with like, you know, some oatmeal and a granola bar or something where like before it was like, there's two extra days of food there. Why did I carry that? You know, so that's where that came in handy for sure for me. I thought it was just such good advice. It was just like, yeah, duh, what am I scared about? Weeks before you starve, water is far more important. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know why I was doing that. I think it's just a subconscious thing. You just think, oh, I don't want to starve, blah, 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 blah. So.
Yep. I've done the same thing. What's the best campsite you've ever camped in?
It's a place that I visited every year since 2009 in the Uinta Mountain Range. It's Kuberant Basin. And at one of the lakes there, it literally has a 20-foot long waist high flat kitchen rock next to the fire pit in camp. And so like when you're there, it's, you know how most of the time you have to be like sitting in your chair, cooking on the ground with your stove. This is like having a kitchen counter to cook on. So you do all your stove cooking. You can sit up on it. Like, and what's nice about it is it's so big. You've got like a big group with you. You know, 5 or 6 people cooking at this thing because it's just massive. And then you're like really close lakeside. So like you want to go trout fishing. It's like, you know, literally a hop, skip and a jump from your tent. It's just such a cozy place back in there, and had some interesting experiences. I'll send you some stuff outside of this so you can see what happened in there. But it's I have some interesting history of this place. And then just I go there every year. It's my new Tenkara spot. Like I love taking the Tenkara rod in there because it's just so fun, the fishing. And this spot is just it's so relaxing. It's just has everything you need close by, water. The atmosphere, fishing, just everything is just perfect about it. It really does. You know, you're not supposed to have amenities in the wilderness, but this one actually has amenities just like you wouldn't believe. It's awesome. So if you ever come, I'll take you.
Say the name of the place again.
Kuberant Basin.
Okay, perfect. That sounds awesome.
All these basins on that side of the range were named for like the old sheep farmers.
Uh-huh.
That used to, so they would be like the sheep herder that would move their sheep right. to like summer feed in these drainages before they're, you know, now there's only certain parts of the range where free range sheep and cattle can range. But back in the day, like back in the early 30s and 40s, they could range anywhere they wanted in the range. So most of these drainages, like Allsop and Kuberant, they're named after the rancher that actually would move their sheep up these drainages. So
what is a backpacking meal you could eat every day?
Back to Jim and his freeze dryer, right? So his wife makes this butter, you know, Indian food. You know, a butter chicken is from the Indian food.
Yep.
She freeze dries this butter chicken, and I am telling you, and you know, I love the Mountain House Yellow Curry, like all the curries and stuff that all these different freeze dried companies make. They're pretty good, but this one, hands down, I could eat this. Like if you just put that. Is my dinner for like 5 nights. You won't hear me complain. It is so good. And what we do is we get these little packets of sriracha. We'll rehydrate the thing. And then we squeeze the packet of sriracha because we're hot food lovers. Like I'm a, you know, the Trinidad Scorpion Carolina Reaper lover, as far as the heat and hot peppers are. So like, you know, sriracha is like someone putting ketchup with fries, right?
Yep.
For me, it's just like, it's just the right flavor combo. So you put a little sriracha in it and then stir it up and, oh my God, you're just sitting there nom nom the whole time eating it. It's so delicious. So by hands. And what's nice about it too is it's like home. So you don't have all the preservatives and the sodium and stuff like this. So, you know, to start to finish, that meal is fantastic, man. And I hope Jim's going to make some more. I have to bribe him with some of my calendars I sell this Christmas time, see if his wife will throw a few meals at me when they do their stuff for the year. So. Yeah, it's delicious, man. I'll have to see if I can get him to send you one. You'll know what I'm talking about. It is fantastic. So,
all right, last question. What is the dumbest thing you've ever done when you've been hiking or backpacking?
So, you know, and this comes full circle for our conversation and how I found your podcast and our communications and stuff like that is I had that 3-hour drive from Salt Lake to Elko for the Ruby Crest Trail that I did this summer. And it was a fantastic show listening to you and your dad's stories and stuff like that. And I caught the trip you guys where you actually did the trail that on the way out. But on the way over there, you know, I had checked everything when I had been packing down here. I did let my son kind of play with my stuff while I was. So I had my stove and my measuring cup and my scrubby and my lighter inside my toques. And I had put it back, but I didn't put the stove in there. So I had done the Harrison Pass to South Fork Smith Creek. And I was all so proud of myself. It was 10 miles in. I had like charged it all by myself into South Fork City, got camp set up, got dinner ready to go, opened up my tokes and the stove wasn't in there.
Oh my gosh. What did you do?
Luckily, because they had had the record snow year we had just had, there was no fire restriction. So I just boiled my water on fire. I wasn't planning on having a fire, mind you. I had just brought petroleum jelly soaked cotton balls with me just in case I hypothermia, which I really didn't think was possible. It's just part of my survival kit that I put in my bag with me. And I lit a fire and melted it. What happened was is the guy that had shelled me to the trailhead, he came in and met me at Overland Lake the next time. He had a canister stove. So I just used his the rest of the way. But yeah, the first night in there, I had to boil my water by fire. It was definitely like an episode of Alone for a minute. It was pretty hilarious. I was so angry at myself, but a lot had changed from the Highline trip that we had talked about previously in this conversation that I instead of getting upset about it, I just sent a message to him via my Garmin saying, "Hey, I was an idiot and forgot my stove back in Salt Lake. You're bringing one in, right?" And he's like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Okay, great. See you tomorrow." And so I just rolled with the situation I was in and actually ended up having like a really nice night in there. I had enough hot water left over from my stuff to make tea. And then I had some chicken teriyaki for dinner and I was able to kind of enjoy the sound of the creek in there in South Fork, Smith Creek and the stars. I'll tell you that having 5 days in that wilderness and never having a thunderstorm was pretty strange because I had been to the Rubies before and that was not the case the last time I went there. So that was an interesting experience.
I think you got lucky. I don't know. You said you listened to my episode of my hike or the episode of my hike on the way out. We got rained on every day.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, at all 5 days the day three was the most clouds that we had had and it was literally just cotton balls and a little bit of wind. Like that's it. It was dry the whole time I was there, which is just insane. But yeah, forgetting the stove. So, you know, moral of the story is before you put your tokes in that's where your stove goes. Wherever your stove goes, make sure you check it before you pack your bag and drive 3 hours from Salt Lake to Elko to go hike a trail. That's, yeah, that one. It's funny too. Like when I put that video up of my YouTube video for it, that was like the first comment that a couple of like predominant YouTubers made on there. Like, "Oh no, not the stove." That's how you know you're not perfect. And that definitely rings home that you're human. And, trust me, in 20 years, I've never forgot my stove. I'll never forget it again. I guarantee you. I'll forget something else before I forget my stove next time. I guarantee it. So, yeah, that was pretty dumb. That could have been real bad if I was solo.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Christian Paul, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you very much, Jeremy, for having me. And like I said, you know, anytime you want to come join us out here, you know, just let me know. Keep doing this great podcast, man. The thing that's great about your podcast is that not only do you have like a great conversation about the trail that the people, that those of us walk, but you also give some great historical information on the area. And it's just really, honestly, such a well done format. I'm really honored to be here. So thanks for having me, man.
Thanks again to Christian Paul for coming on the show. And I hope that Christian and I have inspired you to hike the Uinta Highline Trail. And if you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend about it. Or better yet, give us a good review on whichever podcast service you use. And keep in mind that this podcast is entertainment and meant to spark your interest. If you decide to hike the trail, do your own research. Like anything else worth doing, outdoor adventure has risk. So when you go, pack your common sense. And when you get back, tell me how it went. Let's talk about our next episode. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel 1,400 kilometers through a lightly visited but truly legendary region of Europe. We'll stay in private homes and welcoming villages and eat home-cooked meals as we traverse mountains, plateaus, and forests, and we'll have to keep our eyes peeled for sign of this area's most famous historical resident, Vlad Dracula, also known as Vlad the Impaler, or as we have come to know him today in a mythologized form, Count Dracula. That's right. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Via Transilvanica in Transylvania, Romania. If you have any questions or feedback on this episode or ideas for future episodes, including if you want to be a guest and talk about a trail that you've hiked, reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at trailsworthhikingpodcast. So start planning your next hike, and before you know it, you'll be on the trail. Thanks for listening.